Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us today. I'm very privileged and honored to be able to, on behalf of FCC Professional Committee, invite Chandran Nair, founder and CEO of the Global Institute for Tomorrow, to join us today for this luncheon. Forgive me, Chandran, because you haven't been able to eat because we've been talking and distracted by our own conversation, but I think you're all in for a treat. This is a much sought after speaker around the globe, but more important, I think, a sought after thinker, really taking a look at the world through a perspective that very few see it or are even willing to express it. So without further ado, I'd like to invite Chandran Nair. Please give him a warm round of applause. Oh, and this, you could put it on silent. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Angie, and thank you, everyone, for coming. For those of you who may have heard me open my mouth and shoot the breeze on everything, you will know that I tend to be a bit out there. But today I'm going to be about best behavior, partly because I've already got a notorious piece out in Foreign Policy magazine that's made me, I think, very unpopular in certain quarters. So today I'm going to talk about the other 100 and be about best behavior. Okay. I'd like to thank Angie for the invitation of the FCC for this invitation. And really what I thought I'd do is talk for about 20 minutes or so and perhaps take some questions, but show you some pictures, which would, I hope, also inspire you. And then you can all go and buy hundreds of copies of the book as well. We have a kind of bulk discount and things like that, you know. I'm a bit of a salesperson here. What I thought I'd do is say that, firstly, the book is a nonprofit project of the Global Institute for Tomorrow, and we do it by raising sponsorship money, et cetera. And this is our second edition. And the idea is essentially to try and get a book out every 12 to 18 months. So the red one that you see is the second one. The first one was yellow and was the first one that sort of set the theme and tried to get people interested in the name. I'm very pleased to let you know that the media response has been fantastic. Over the last 2 years, we've had coverage in over 120 media outlets from the BBC, Bloomberg, CNN, et cetera. And we've been very pleased to have the book seen in many places and the media responds so well to the book. I want to just talk for a few minutes about where did the idea come from. Then the process by which we got people to all around the world to contribute to the book, and then just show you some nice pictures about who these people are. So the idea, I mean, the idea has many levels, and I'll focus on where I'm coming from in terms of this thing. And I thought I'd show you the first slide, which is a quote by Pankaj Mishra. You all probably know of the Indian author who's today, I think, recognized as one of the most prominent writers in the world. And Pankaj is a friend, and I asked him to write the introduction to the first book. And I think this kind of captures what I was hoping to do, but in a much more articulate than I am. And Pankaj, in the first book, said, "So what is the good life? Since the dawn of history, this inquiry has motivated the making of art as well as philosophy. But the many answers to it were never as radically shrunk as they were in the 19th century, when the good life became confused with the desires and achievements of a tiny minority." So the first book for me was something that I found the courage to say, I need to express something that I've been feeling for a long time. And in the first book, I wrote the foreword, and I essentially said something to the effect that for a long time, the idea of the lists of the most famous, the richest, the most beautiful, somehow I had a perverse fascination with this, going back to when I was a kid. partly mainly because none of those people looked like anyone I knew. None of them lived in my hood. None of them spoke like I did. And even further, none of them seemed to have any of the values that I was taught were important in seeking to define one's life, one's achievements, one's career, etc. But it seemed more and more that one could not challenge that narrative about who are these people. But then, you know, in 2012, I mustered the courage, given that the Global Institute had a small brand, to say, let's go and try this. Let's see if it will resonate with people. So my first idea was to take what the one you all are aware of, which is the list of the richest 100, the Forbes list, not to have some rant about rich people, because this is not anti-rich or pro-poor, but to ask the question and then begin that journey, which, you know, every owner of the book or the books will begin to ask themselves. If there is such a thing as the world's richest 100, then surely the intellectual response is, well, who are the other 100? So that's where the name came from. Who are the other 100? Because the other 100 surely cannot be a publication around the poorest 100. Because tongue in cheek, you would not find them. In fact, where would you? How would you begin that process? What metrics would you use to find the poorest 100? And therein, my own sort of perverse thinking about, well, actually, the idea that the richest 100 essentially represent some ideal that most of us aspire to is a lie. That in fact, most of the world do not aspire to be billionaires, do not know what it is to be a billionaire. In fact, what does that $1 billion look like? But it's not to suggest that people don't want to have better lives either. So that first book was essentially an attempt to say that 80% of the world lives on about $20 a day. And if they all aspired to be billionaires, we'd be in deep whatever. We'd be in deep trouble. And this is not possible. So the idea that you'd glorify the richest people and somehow say this is an aspiration for everyone is somehow such a distortion of the world we live in that we need to think differently. And that in essence, most people live very different lives. They measure their success in different ways. They don't get up in the morning saying, I want to IPO my company. Let's go and talk to the gems in Hong Kong or something like that. They don't seek to be on the front page of Fortune magazine. They are involved in very different, much more day-to-day routines. And that's where the world is. So that's what the book was all about. So let me just show you, you know, the stuff that I wonder, why do we have the stuff? And anyway, Bill Gates is an okay guy. I mean, I just want to put it out there. He, in fact, I think last year said something that I've been saying for a long time. I don't think he stole it from me, though. He said, you know, interconnectedness is overrated. Because I've always been saying that the fact that we'll all be interconnected and somehow we'll all be clicking our way to freedom and greater liberty and richness is a complete lie. And I was very interested in Bill Gates, actually, in a major interview last year, said interconnectedness is overrated. But it's this sort of imagery that, you know, really kind of bugged me. Why? And I thought we should have a way to describe the others who do fantastic things, but you never hear of, creative entrepreneurs who don't make $1 billion, don't get involved in a Ponzi scheme, which is, you know, kind of tech company thing, right? And are really very part of the fabric of our societies. So this is what I wanted to kind of challenge, and not in any way try to demonize the achievement or downplay the achievements of these people. I'm also very fascinated by the idea that there's such a thing as the 100 most beautiful women or the 100 most sexiest men. None of them look like my brothers or sisters or my friends or, you know, whatever. But it's a kind of strange idea if you think about it. And no sort of big fat black women, things like that. Anyway, it's a very interesting idea anyway. Okay, but yeah, I lived in Africa. So I was very interested in this idea about what is beautiful, why the fascination with that. But that's getting a bit cheeky. Now let me go to, therefore, the process that we embarked on. So to do this, I was very keen that, you know, we'd try and write a coffee table book, a produce a coffee table book that is very different from any other coffee table book out there. How many of you have got a coffee table book? All of you got one? Yes. And most of us have bought a coffee table book on a kind of whim. We've seen a great image, and we said, I got to have that. I've got a few, too. And I realized that actually I never went back to any of them because apart from a couple of images capturing my imagination, it was essentially sterile. Some photographer went into some place and took a picture of someone without asking them. It was beautiful. But there was no story behind that. Great photography, but I wanted to also kind of redefine the coffee table book. So we said, let's go out to the world and ask people, photojournalists, to subscribe, to send in pictures around the first book, which is just called The Other 100. And it was very interesting, the response we got. We got more than 25,000 submissions from all around the world, 160 countries, and in the space of within 6 months. So somehow it resonated with people. The first book, we sent an advance notice to the BBC 6 months before the book came out, but on the week of the Academy Awards in 2013, and the next day the BBC called us up and said, can you come and talk to us about the book? The reason, again, it touched a chord during the week when all the fuss was about overrated B-movie actors and actresses. And they wanted to know something else. And I don't know if any book gets a BBC kind of interview 6 months before publication. We didn't even have a cover. But that was the level of interest we thought that we had sort of touched. So this is some books from, this is my thing, and I should turn it off. I always do this. The first book was essentially about just the other 100. So I'm going to show you some images that we got submitted from around the world. Ordinary people leading very interesting lives. This is essentially from Singapore. An image of Singapore that you probably often do not see at all. A single mother, Mila, of a family of eight in one of the most expensive and most unequal cities. Now, one of the things we did with the book was we didn't want it just to be pictures. So every submission had to have a story and a name. So we had, actually, interestingly, some extremely well-known photographers who sent us, you know, here's a picture, I'm famous, and we rejected them. I'm not in the good books of some of the world's most famous photographers, by the way, because we rejected them, because no story, and essentially not capturing the essence of what we were trying to say with The Other 100. No stereotypes, but deep insights. So this image in the book is accompanied by some facts about Singapore in terms of the socioeconomic realities of Singapore. And I think we put in two factoids there around salaries and minimum wage, etc. And that's what we try to accompany each photograph with. This is, for me, one of my most favorite. There's three pictures about Pakistan. And for me, this is a very interesting one because, you know, most of us think about Pakistan as full of mad mullahs, violence, everything is out of control, and no one's pensive, and people are not thinking. And this is a photographer who took a picture on a train of passengers sitting and all of them looking out of the window and thinking. And there were, I think, four other people on that in the story, and each one had a name. So you looked at these people, and you had a name. You understood they were, a farmer, a mechanic, a teacher, or an accountant, and there they were on the train. But then I wanted to go a bit further and say, what is the name of the train? So we found out the name of the train. And then I wanted people to understand that Pakistan is not this, you know, way out place where everyone's crazy and it's unsafe, and no one's interested in even looking at a map of Pakistan. So we got a map of Pakistan and showed the journey of that train from the cities, at least to give people an idea that they are cities, they have some beautiful names, and they have long histories. And if you're interested, you can go and Google it. and you can find out a bit more. And I was very touched when someone very prominent in Hong Kong told me that when he read the book about Pakistan, to his kids, he went to the Atlas with his kids, looked at the map, and they went and bought a book about Pakistan the next day to learn a bit more about the country. So that's really kind of where the story is going. Bangladesh. You don't associate Bangladesh with love and romance. And that's the picture we had. And a very interesting story about a couple who come from different religions. China. Sadly, most stories I see about China is about pollution, oppression, bad government, corruption. Anything else negative someone want to say? But you know what I mean. So here was Morganshan in China, tea growing area, blue skies, happy people. I'm not saying that we are trying to depict a China that's not real, but this is more real than what you see all the time in the media, a nasty China. Laos. A story about the women's group who essentially diffused the unexploded ordinances left by the Vietnam War. And we put a factoid there for those who don't remember the war too, to just get people to think these women are doing an incredible job. We have all their names, but also remind people that during the Vietnam War, more bombs were dropped in Laos than the entire Second World War in Europe. One B-52 bomber every 9 minutes for about 9 years. Most people have forgotten this, just to remind people. But then they are not complaining. They're going ahead and doing one of the most difficult jobs in the world, and we have their names. This is from Mali. This picture is great. But these are the blacksmiths of Mali, one of the most respected professions in Mali. And I was very interested that when we got writers to come in and write for us, one of the things I tried to do with the book was also get people to write essays. So you had a photo book, pictures, had to have a story. We included some factoids, but I then went out and sought 10 writers from different corners of the world representing the different continents to write. So we managed to find the most famous Chinese living poet living today in Hong Kong to write a poem about it, to write a story. And he flicked through all the pictures and he says, I want to write about the blacksmiths. So I said, why do you want to do that? And he said, during the Cultural Revolution, I had to be a blacksmith. And so he understood the whole thing about the blacksmiths, and he wrote a very interesting poem for the book. I won't tell you what the poem is. I'd like you to kind of buy the book and share it with friends. Another one was, this is about Africa. And the thing we were trying to do was to also demolish stereotypes. So we received thousands of pictures about Africa, the usual stuff. You all seen those? Black kid, snot, flies, tin plate, dirt floor. You all know that one? And then all these good Samaritans are going to help them. So I didn't want those, so we rejected a lot of them. Rwanda, when you think of Rwanda today, every image is about the unfortunate genocide that happened there. But someone sent us this one of Letitia, who is essentially one of the most sought-after coffee experts in Rwanda. And then we put a map of the world and showed you where your coffee comes from and where Rwandan coffee actually goes to. Some of that probably comes to Hong Kong. And to just get people to think about the connections in terms of what people do and how countries have moved beyond the stereotype. But even me, someone who's slightly worldly and lived in Africa, I hadn't imagined that there would be a young woman in Rwanda who is an expert coffee taster. Yeah. Then there's Russia. This I love. Two sisters who live in a remote part of Russia and who essentially cater for all their needs and grow all their food and live very happily in a very beautiful part of Russia. All we hear about Russia, unfortunately, is about Putin and Ukraine, and forget that it's a country with a long history. I'm going to move. This is a very interesting one, and you'll think as well. I want you to also imagine that one of the things we want to do is say the other 100 is not just brown and black people and some Chinese and other, you know, those third world types. We want to say that the other 100 exists in all societies, so we have all continents covered. So this is European. And you'll notice that in Europe, this is in Germany, one of the most advanced economies in the world. And Martin lives in all in a one-room home without mains, electricity, or running water, 1 kilometer for the nearest village. He grows his own vegetables. He's a handyman. He takes care of everything. And it was a choice. The longer story talks about how Martin essentially gave up his job in the city because he wanted to live a different life. And so he's not poor. He's completely self-contained. He's an engineer. He's built this very simple way of living and very fulfilled, and is a member, a strong member of the community. That's in Germany. What I didn't want to do was have Germany represented with someone from Somalia or Turkey, if you see what I mean. That the other 100 is some immigrant who is a burden on the society. This is a Greek in Greece, and we love this picture. You know, austerity in the Greeks. So this is a wedding party, and the Greeks are having it in a Shell station, and someone smoking as well. But that's kind of very Greek. So that's like, you know, no rules matter, so who cares? But this one was actually republished in The Guardian and a couple of others because they loved the idea of the Greeks partying away. And, you know, people live on, even with austerity. And I hope they weren't smoking the cigarette, but there you go. This is one of my favorites. During that when we did the first one, we had numerous pictures from the Middle East. And most of them was of Arab Spring. Usually mayhem, war, and all of the death and destruction. We got hundreds of those pictures from very, very famous photographers. We had one, technically, probably the most brilliant photo we received from a very famous photographer of a Syrian woman sniper who essentially lost her husband who was in the army of the government and who now wanted to take revenge. And you could see that the photograph, technically brilliant, was her on a sofa, very well lit, etc., and taking her gun out of a handbag. And we rejected this. I didn't think this was what the other 100's about. This is about how life goes on. Someone sent us from the city of Aleppo four traders, the people who keep the society together in the midst of mayhem and destruction. So I love this picture because it's got the baklava, shopkeeper. He doesn't look too happy, but I can understand that. The butcher, the guy who's selling a bit of gasoline, and then the fruit merchant. That for me was the other 100 at a time of great distress. And then Iran, demonized all over. And anyone been to Iran? Yeah, I've been there 3 times, and you know, it's not what you see on CNN. But again, we had a photographer who represented the country very differently, and a retired English teacher called Muhammad, who earns his keep also by doing street photography, and dressed very European, I dare say. And I think the Ayatollahs allowed that. And this is from the U.S. So we had numerous submissions from the U.S., but this one is one of my favorites as well. That the idea that most people think that everyone in America has got a lot of money, etc., but there is a huge underclass, and they're not just black. Most of the other 100 pictures we got from the U.S. were of black people. So the three we picked, the U.S., China, and India, got 3 stories each in our first one because they're the largest countries. But here was a very interesting story of teenage children visiting a wealthy neighborhood in Texas to enjoy the Christmas decorations they couldn't have at home, and just sitting and watching it from a car, and the family lives in a trailer. So the second one, the other 100 entrepreneurs. I got 5 minutes more. And for me, when we thought of the second one, we were struggling with, now we get a bit more thematic. And for me, the next one was clearly the entrepreneurs, because I was also sick and tired. I speak a lot about entrepreneurship around the world, and I'm always very worried that every 21-year-old now wants to be an entrepreneur and be a billionaire by the time they are 23 years old, and usually they think it'll come via designing some app. And this is a very dangerous idea. So I try and disabuse them of this idea that they will all be rich and famous by being entrepreneurs. So it was the idea was to return the word entrepreneurship to its roots by capturing a tiny part of the enormous variety of people and ways in which entrepreneurship is exercised and manifests itself around the world, across cultures, classes, and genders. And the fact that in this part of the world, small entrepreneurs contribute something like 75% of the GDP. They're not large companies. In Africa, it's more than 50%. So here's an example. I'll run through. This is in Hanoi, a Vietnamese woman who runs a very interesting small business that essentially looks to save the lives of children born with postnatal disorders, etc., prematurely. And this is a huge problem in Vietnam, partly, of course, due to Agent Orange manifestations, genetic defects, etc., but a great social enterprise doing some very good work. Second, and I wish Hong Kong would do this, but I'm trying to get the Hong Kong government convinced, Singapore, where they have enabled, essentially, urban gardens. And this is a great example of an urban garden, more high-tech that is being done in Singapore. This is our Hong Kong man. We tried to get him to an exhibition and speak, but he's elusive. I think he's busy. He's busy. But Raymond went from a no-name tailor to a designer to the stars. Small shop in Hong Kong. I don't think he's in the Landmark, but I think he's somewhere in the Kowloon area. Causeway Bay? Causeway Bay area. This was one of the pictures that caught the imagination of many of the judges. Oh, by the way, I should say that the selection of the photos and the stories is done by a panel of judges. We have an international panel of about six judges from around the world who assemble in Hong Kong, and we spend 3 days going through thousands of pictures. But there is some software that helps us, just for those of you who are interested. This is one of the favorites amongst the judges, a four-person business painting the exteriors of high-rise towers in Kolkata. You'll notice no safety harness, etc. But these guys are so ambitious. We have all the names in terms of what they plan to do. This is another favorite of ours, and a lot of people like it. This is the Fatal Fatal Mercedes Garage, run by three women and a business in Senegal. Again, when we think of Senegal, we just think of, yeah, I don't know what we think of, but we certainly don't think of this in progress, okay? This is Ibrahim, who essentially makes bamboo bicycles, and now has got a market both in the US and in Europe. Very cool bamboos. We'd like to bring some to Hong Kong, at least to show them off. Yeah. This is another favorite. This is Filani, 24, who loves to read, doesn't have a job, and said, you know, I'll go and get some secondhand books, read them, and I'll sit on a pavement and sell them. And he does it all the time, and people buy the books from him. This has also become quite a favorite amongst people. Not just a photograph, but the story of a guy who loves to read and says, I buy books, and I finish them, I will sell them secondhand. And he's doing quite well. He reviews them too. Sorry, missed the story, guys. Thank you. So he reviews them too. When you think of Uganda, most people still think of Idi Amin. And I asked someone the other day in Malaysia, so Uganda, what do you know? Isn't that Idi Amin? Well, Uganda has moved on. So this is a lovely picture of, you know, we don't have too many startups, by the way, thankfully, in our red book. I think we only have like two kind of, you know, tech kind of businesses. So this is a startup in Kampala, where these guys are doing some amazing things using available technology, and even in Kampala looking at something to do with how you can get a taxi very quickly. I love this picture. This is from Italy, someone who restores antiques and old pieces of art and restoring works in mosques, churches, cathedrals, etc. A real art. He ain't looking to become a billionaire, never will. Russia, two guys who create industrial sculptures as toys, and they have a huge market in Russia and elsewhere. One of these toys apparently takes anything from 6 to 12 months to make. They have moving parts, etc., but it's a dying art. It's a toy that moves and built from a range of both metal and wood, but they're all moving parts, and they do engineering drawings to frame them, etc. I'm going to finish. This one, anyone understand what this one is? This is in Iran. And you may think, what on hell is that? But this is a file, and we were just surprised. This shows you the range of stuff we got. So someone in Iran sent this to us and said, here's a farmer who who apparently is so pissed off with the nomadic people coming through his land and destroying everything with their cattle and horses, etc., but also felt sorry for them because they had to go many kilometers before they could cross the river, and so they used to come through his land to do it. So he said, I could do them a pulley system to take the animals across. We've got some more weird pictures of this, anyone who's interested, okay? I mean, we have pictures of, I think, sheep tied around their legs, hanging over this gorge and being pulled across. And I think someone from Greenpeace saw it and wrote us a nasty letter saying this is cruelty to animals. I don't know, you know. But this guy makes some money every year when the nomadic tribes come across and try and cross. Entrepreneurship, right? It's not central, but it's out there in Iran. This too, basically a builder's cooperative in Iraq, rebuilding homes. They run it as a cooperative, they get funding, but they are self-sufficient. I mean, they're not going to be Sanungay or Chung Kong, but you know, they might in 50 years, we don't know, but this is Iraq. This is incredible. This is in Canada. Angie, you identify with that? You've been there? You're not cool, man. But anyway, these guys run these, you know, shelters. Many of us have seen probably in the developed world, sort of slightly crazy people who collect things. But one of these guys actually does something else. That he never sells anything. He actually only lets you to loan them for a fee. He wants it back. And he thinks you might get tired of it anyway. So you can have it for about a year, and then you have to bring it back and take something else. It's quite a good business model because, you know, you can get probably return on that single piece for much more over a 10-year period. This is New York, and I know we all think about just Wall Street, etc., but here are those individuals who do weird things still and who just carry on repairing guitars. This guy, I think, runs a wine cellar. She does pottery, and this woman repairs bags. But I just wanted to show you that even in and we have this in Hong Kong too, people doing those things. One of my favorites, a bespoke leather shoe shop in Argentina, in Buenos Aires. And a very interesting story. We have the names, we have a lot of photographs about them, and how there's a family business, and you know, the old man is a bit worried whether his son will keep the business up. But they have fantastic shoes. If you want to order the shoes, we got the website. I mean, it's cool. It's cheaper than getting it at Landmark, okay? But there is a carbon footprint involved. And this one is from Haiti. We don't have the entrepreneur's picture in this one, but we have. I think we have it on our website. But she was an engineer, Haitian, who after the earthquake felt that, as we all know in Nepal, one of the reasons for a lot of the casualties is just poor building materials. So she decided to build a small business with reinforced bricks to help people rebuild. And that is an amazing story of an entrepreneur doing social good. And these are my brothers from Congo. With that, I'll let you kind of digest what we're trying to do. I think I've said everything I wanted to say, but ultimately, we want to produce a book every 18 months or 12. And there is a subversive agenda in challenging the narrative. What is the entrepreneur? Who are the other 100? And our next one might be called the other 100 educators. No Ivy League, none of those prestigious conveyor belt schools. Who are the other 100 educators? And we are trying to ask that if I wanted to tell the story of inequality in the world, and I had been thinking about writing a book about it, it would be 300 pages, lots of stats, the ones that I selectively pick. 5,000 people, if I'm lucky, will read it around the world. Nobody would care. But if you could tell it through an appreciation of the world through this sort of story, a much larger audience begins to understand. And who cares if The Economist doesn't review it? But the important thing is the school's dead. And by the way, the first book, I think, is doing the rounds around the schools in Hong Kong. Yeah? So we are trying to get an exhibition around the school. So the first one's already doing a round. And it's getting teachers to talk about the world in a very different way. And I'll finish by saying, I'm so keen that this project gets embedded in people in Hong Kong thinking about it. Because I think one of the difficulties we have in Hong Kong is we navel gaze. We think everything starts here and ends here. This is a very small place. And if younger people in Hong Kong understood the world is a bigger place in which people achieve much more with much less than we have, then they might understand that they can go and do greater things of a different nature. So we're trying to get this. So if you know anyone rich, one of the things I'd like to do is have all 200 images that we have from both books installed in as a large print, 4x8, on all those walkways in Hong Kong, not just in Central, but right through the New Territories, with a story so that people can get inspired and understand the world better and cherish perhaps a bit more what we have here. So thank you very much for coming. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm happy to take a few questions. Thank
yes,
you.
Yes, thank you so much, Andrew. Well, you're right at home because we are a club of storytellers, and thank you for bringing your stories right here to us. I'd like to open it up to the audience. Just raise your hands. Any questions from the group? I think as you think about it, I think what you've challenged us to think about and to reflect on is the definition of success, the definition of aspiration, because it's not defined the same by everyone, right?
Yeah, I think it's clear that we all have different definitions, and in a way that's also an old thought. But what I wanted to do was bring it to life by imagery and stories so that it would touch people to think about those things rather than think it's some sort of an academic discourse about success. And when you put it in pictures and in contrast with others, then people start to have a conversation. I can give you one example of this. I took a copy of the book to one of China's richest men. And he invited me to his house for dinner with his parents, who don't speak a word of English. And I gave them the book. And the next hour was this uncontrollable conversation about why this picture and not why this one. Why this one from Africa and why not this? Which country is this? Where is this town? I mean, but if we had a conversation about success without the stories of people from different worlds, I don't think it had been that animated, and nothing might have stuck in people's minds. I think the images and the names provide a different platform. And in a way, it's, you know, without overstating it, I see it as a bit of a sort of art project. You look, you come to your own conclusions, you decide, you have the argument and discussion.
All right. Any last thoughts, Chandra? Oh, here's one. Thank you.
You may be doing it to try and make a point, but you're stressing about the billionaires. You start a business or are an entrepreneur to become a billionaire. I don't think that's the case. For myself and my friends that have businesses, it was far more about your own destiny. Once the business was successful, it was more about looking after the team and the people and their families. Money is way down on the list.
I'm not sure how I perhaps conveyed that message, but you've exactly expressed what I'm talking about. I mean, I'm an entrepreneur too. I've been fairly successful, but like you, none of us sought to go and become rich. And it's a relative concept. The point I was trying to make, which I think I didn't clearly make clearly enough, but which you picked up on, is that most of the world achieves things in different ways, and we're all driven by different things. The point I was trying to make was that I do think, and that we can debate if my point is valid or not, I think there's an oversimplification of what is success in mainstream media, and that's the point I'm trying to make. Mainstream media does not acknowledge the achievements of the others. And the world is a very big place, and I think we would inspire many more people to try many more things if we told them there's a whole range of things you could do. rather than glorifying as it does in a simple way, which is the point you're making, it's not true that everyone, you know, seeks to become a billionaire and becomes a billionaire. Because if you put images of people who are very wealthy and said that's what drives them, then you send the message to everyone that they went after that and that only. But the point you're making is some of us get lucky, some of us don't. And some of us don't aspire to accumulate that much. We stop at a certain time because we have other aspirations as well, taking care of people, etc. So I hope that clarifies the point I'm trying to make. But I want to say that this is not about anti-rich or pro-poor. This is not it was an attempt to say that the world is a lot more complex than we think. And the middle is actually a huge spectrum of people who are not to be, never represented in mainstream media.
Well, sometimes I disagree with that, I think. I think at the end of the day, what it is there are perceptions of stories that are out there, and it really is the value of each individual story that I think elevates us all as humans. So thank you for being a storyteller. There's one more question over here.
Just a very quick one. I mean, Hong Kong always been known in the older days that, you know, we're on entrepreneurship, you know, we're very strong on that, and we were reputable of this drive and, you know, entrepreneurial spirit. But lately everybody was saying that, you know, that spirit's going downhill. I mean, what's your thoughts on that?
Well, I'm no expert, but I wrote a piece about this, about Hong Kong's woes at the moment. And I think the moment you turn an entire economy to be dependent on two pillars, which is financial leverage and property, which is also leverage, then I don't think you can have much room for entrepreneurship in that space. And frankly, you know, it's very difficult for someone who wants to start up a shop today in a decent area to even pay the rents. I mean, so you completely distort the economy when you have essentially an economy that is so narrowly bound around essentially speculative investments and essentially on property. You have a distortion. And I think this is what we had, this sort of outburst of protests, etc., going back 6 months based on, so where is my chance? I have a great idea. But to even do something, you know, I'm going to have $1 million. In no other country do you need to have that access to capital to start something. So I think this is Hong Kong's dilemma, and why you see a sort of drop in the sort of the spirit of entrepreneurship, which, as far as I understand from you, was essentially the fabric of what made Hong Kong what it is today. I mean, Frank, can anyone tell me who was the last most successful entrepreneur that became a bit famous in Hong Kong? I don't think anyone, but I would argue there are still many entrepreneurs, but they're smaller, okay? But there is a decline, and I would argue because of this concentration of the economy on essentially two sectors only. And we tried to say that the entrepreneur is also the guy who buys the books, reviews it, and then tries to sell it. In Hong Kong, would you make a living like that? No chance, because the rental needs force you to do something. I mean, my little business, you know, which is a kind of think tank, I look high and low for smart Hong Kong people to come and work for us. High and low. Can I find them? No. Are there no smart people in Hong Kong? Of course. But if you're 28, very smart in Hong Kong, you're going to work in property or you're going to work in the financial sector. We can't afford that. So you have this huge segmentation of where the talent goes, and therefore the creative people essentially have to sacrifice some of that to pay the rent. So they choose not to be in that sector. So you have this, I think, this kind of disconnect that we can't tap into the creative need of the creative people in Hong Kong because the rent comes first. And you can't blame a 28-year-old who's well-educated to say, you know, I can't live on $35,000. Most other countries, $35,000 is a lot of money. So I think that those are why entrepreneurship in Hong Kong is not visible as it used to be. And clearly the economies, the times have changed.
At one point, China was essentially the basis on which you could see the thrust of leveraging entrepreneurial spirit. Today, the Chinese are the entrepreneurs themselves. So the Hong Kong entrepreneurs have had to compete. That time, they didn't have to compete. So that was a bit more of a free ride. Now they have to compete. And I would argue our young and brightest are not equipped to compete with the rest of the world.
You pay teachers and artists the same you pay financial firms and bankers and investment bankers. I think you'd see an interesting bubble of talent. But anyway, it is an interesting debate and line of thinking that you've started, Chandran. And thank you so much for joining us at the FCC. And thank you all for joining us as well. Before I ask you to give Chandran a round of applause, I'd like to do some housekeeping and invite you to consider some more events that our professional committee is creating for you, including Life in Hong Kong Prisons. Speaker is Tobias Brandner. He's a prison chaplain, associate professor, Department of Cultural and Religious Studies at Chinese University of Hong Kong. He's going to be speaking here on Monday, May 11th. And then the secret agenda of strongman Xi Jinping. For the record, that was not my title. I'm just reading it. Don't shoot the messenger, whoever's keeping note. Speaker is Dr. Willie Lam, and he will be joining us here May 13th on Wednesday. So I hope that you will join us for those as well. But thank you for joining, and thank you, Chandran.
Thank you.
We enjoyed having you.